had that cold for a while, and having also damp weather before that. And so anyway, mm-hmm. it's been quite a while since I've been here because of the total mix-up I made with missing January the 2nd, I think it was.
And day after New Year's Eve, you kind of get more forgetful.
Anyway, whatever it is. And I really apologize for that. But anyway, things do happen. I'd like to acknowledge that on Wooden Spoons, we are located on Treaty 1 territory, the traditional land and waters of the Cree, Ojibwe, Ojibwe Cree, Dakota, and Dene people, as well as the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis homeland. We also acknowledge the Shoal Lake, number 40, First Nation, and its territory for our life-giving water. For this morning, just a quick rundown. We do have a guest who I'll be introducing very shortly. Her name is Rachel Dunsmore, and for the first part of the program, and we also, as time permits, I will share some information concerning different issues, one of them being information from Organic Consumer Association, and some information from an organization called ECHO, and information about programs at Mary Jane's Cooking School, and we have also a recipe. So there's quite a few things that that are on the agenda this morning. And so at this point, I understand that Rachel is on air right now. Hello, Rachel.
Hello, good morning, Mary Jane. Good morning, John.
Morning.
Okay, so you had a good Christmas, Rachel?
I did, yes. All is well.
Well, that's
well as can be. Thank you.
Okay. Well, just as an introduction, Rachel, I want to say that you were once on the air with Rico John on Fantastic Friday, and but for the past several years, you have been a student at the University of Manitoba. Rachel has a keen interest in gerontology, and after completing her master's degree, and she's now working on her PhD, her research title is Social Identity and Power, Older Adults as Care Recipients in Media Content on Family Care. That's quite a title. An abstract on the research paper involved Rachel Antonio Dunsmore, Laura Funk, and Dana Sawchuk, Department of Sociology and Criminology, University of Manitoba, Canada, and Sociology from Wilfrid Laurier University, Waterloo, Canada. So today we'll be talking to Rachel about the focus of her studies in gerontology. So, Rachel, as we begin, your abstract on the study identifies several topics, such as how care for older adults is presented as being burdensome, having complex care needs, being incapacitated or incompetent, and often having dementia, as well as being a burden on caregivers. Would you comment on the effect of these oft-used designation of elderly people on both the elderly and the caregivers?
Sure. Thank you, Mary Jane and John, for having me today. And my PhD dissertation research is a separate study that I'm currently drafting. But the full article which you mentioned, Older Adults as Care Recipients in Media Content on Family Care, is available freely online if you search the title. And that research was based on a review of mainstream media coverage in Canada on the topic of family caregiving, looking at several years of media coverage. And we found that care and support with and for older adults or the growing elderly population is largely presented or framed as burdensome, with especially the diagnosis of dementia used very freely or indiscriminately. So cognitive impairment is a possibility throughout one's life, as well as different needs for care across our lives. What we wanted to highlight is how we tend to talk about caring with and for older adults or the elderly population. It always seems to be rather negative, particularly in media coverage, that the elderly population is burdensome, or even this very dangerous idea that the elderly population is redundant to society. And this was reflected in media coverage and, in our view, contributes to ageism, to marginalizing or devaluing both older adults and those who try to care or accompany them on what some might alternatively consider to be a sacred life stage or a sacred time in one's life if we reach an elderly point.
Yeah, and that's a very good point that you're making, because the older the person gets, they have a different perspective on life as well. And I think that they're you know, in a different phase and have different, very different ways of seeing things possibly and understanding things. Would you say that's true?
Right. Certainly.
And so,
yeah, I mean, yeah. I think the more time that you're alive, right, you have, I mean, first of all, you've contributed in various ways to society through family or work or just different activities, whatever a person has been involved with. And yeah, in time, our perspective changes, right? I mean, no matter how old we are, if we reflect now, looking back on our lives about how our perspective has changed, I can't imagine if I reach my 80s or 90s how my perspective will be different.
Yeah, I recall quite a while ago, I used to work at the West End Senior Center, and there was a woman by the name of Isabella Dryden, and she was elderly. I think she was in her 90s, and she was teaching adults how to use the computer. And I know one of my friends was had taken a course with her, and she was really on top of things and very serious about her work. And she was a no-nonsense person, but people really learned a lot from her. So she was really an amazing person. I recall she was in her 90s when she was still teaching.
Mm-hmm.
So
she probably had a good insight on how to connect with people and teach people according to where they were at.
Yeah. And I think maybe she was a bit old school, too, in her perspective. But she was a very good teacher. And, so how does the mainstream media report on elderly people? And how are the caregivers being portrayed? So when caregivers are seen as being burdened, as you were pointing out, by having to care for their elderly parents, what does that say about both sides, the elderly and the caregiver? Do you want to comment on that dynamic?
Sure. Right. So for this research, again, we reviewed 38 articles over a six-year time frame in mainstream English language newspapers across Canada that covered the topic of family caregiving. And for the most part, the voices and perspectives of older adults are largely absent. And instead, we hear mostly from those positioned as experts on population aging and care from family members and other third parties. So this in itself sort of reinforces the assumption that older people are unable to speak for themselves, such that their voices are not even solicited in the first place. So family members can, for example, be an important perspective to include, Sometimes family members are important and needed advocates for an older family member. But when we're discussing the topic of care of the elderly, it's important that we should hear from elderly people themselves. And even in a situation where a person may have cognitive impairment, they're still there and they can still express themselves. So when we assume that a person is lost or gone, it's really often our own failure to observe and listen. And these are also very dangerous assumptions. If a person, or in this case, an entire population or cohort, is assumed to be lost, gone, or out of it, as we often hear, they are more likely to be neglected and abused or even criminally victimized, with the idea being that it's inconsequential because the person is, quote, out of it. And this is really happening at a time in one's life where one may need the most love and care. And also arguably where, as you said, Mary Jane, one may have the most to give, especially in terms of love or insight or perspective on the human condition. And then for those of us who are trying to assist an older person's quality of life, if we think about care as burdensome or negative, we may not consider how this thinking can reinforce our own and the other person's sense of perhaps isolation, especially if these messages are repeated over time and from a variety of sources, such as in this case through the media or from other people, just in everyday conversation. We risk internalizing all this negative messaging and then being unable to value and really appreciate the importance or the gift of accompanying an older person. And this accompaniment can also provide a sense of purpose and value. So this is not to dismiss the very real challenges that can be involved in caregiving, especially if our efforts are unsupported by others, or unsupported by our employers and so forth, but always trying to direct our perspective outward toward advocating for the help that's needed. It's very, very easy to blame a person needing help or needing care, but it really can become self-defeating.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. It just makes me think, too, of sometimes the elderly get along very well with children, I think. I remember my grandfather. I mean, he was my friend. And we were like companions. And I know that people thought he was, you know, maybe not quite all there and that sort of thing. But we got along very well. And I think there's another facet to the relationships when the elderly and children can be really, really have a really good friendship and a loving relationship.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. And I mean, if our cognition is really only one part of our personhood or what it means to be human. So, I mean, just because someone may, you know, just to put it generally, be forgetful or experience some level of cognitive impairment really doesn't make the person any less human. And the brain is an organ system, along with many other organ systems in the body. And just because we may physically decline doesn't mean we're no longer there. We actually might even have more to offer in other ways, right?
Yeah, that's true. You're listening to CKOW 95.9 FM. And our guest today is Rachel Dunsmore. And we're talking about her studies, her work on the on her master's degree. John, did you have any comments or questions?
Not at the moment, no.
Okay. Would you comment, Rachel, on the topic of ageism and how that is portrayed by the media and how elder abuse is rooted in ageism? According to your research, one way of viewing ageism is that the elderly are more vulnerable to interpersonal crime, such as telephone scams and fraud.
Right. So a key part of ageism is victim blaming, and this includes thinking that older people are at risk of cognitive impairment or at risk of fraud and other abuses simply because they are old. So we tend to think of the core problem as their age, and this idea that older adults are victims of their own age and therefore need to be managed or controlled by others. This idea is actually a slippery slope and has led to widespread acceptance of human rights violations and even criminal victimization of older adults. So in an ageist society, these controlling or managing attitudes become normalized as in the older person's best interest, for example, on account of their safety, or even talked about as just a natural part of being old. In reality, growing old is simply part of the life course. It reminds us of our shared vulnerability and our changing need for care across our lives. And we've reached a time in history where the focus has been on trying to improve health and lengthen the lifespan. Now we've reached a point where many of us can and do live longer, but then it seems to be presented as a burden. And I often joke with colleagues, like, what is next? Will we blame babies for being babies and having the needs of babies? Like, oh, babies are so burdensome, you know, they can't hold their head up and they need attention. And like, I mean, that's life. This is the nature of the human life course. So yes, in part, one can become elderly and become vulnerable because a person can become more dependent on others for their care. But again, this fluctuates for all of us over our lives. Like if I am ill, if I am in an accident, if I am in, have a surgery, like I am more vulnerable at that time because I'm more dependent on others for my daily life. But that doesn't, like it doesn't need to be negative. And we all reach those points at different times, and growing elderly is one of them. Older adults are largely vulnerable to ill treatment because of how we view old age, because we view it as a tragic life stage that should be avoided. And this is evidenced by the enormous anti-aging industry. We don't want to appear old, lest we be treated as old, which is often to be treated disrespectfully. And when we look across our society, we try not to even see or be part of this life stage, in part by warehousing the elderly population in facilities or largely behind closed doors. So the elderly aren't vulnerable simply because they're old, but largely because of how we think about old age, which in turn shapes how we treat older people. And being isolated or put away is actually a huge risk factor for neglect and abuse. So isolation is a social practice and a choice and not a natural outcome of being old. So again, it's very easy to look at an elderly person or look at a situation where someone's trying to support an elderly person and frame the elderly person as burdensome. But we're sort of just neglecting the nature of the human condition when we do that.
Well, you made a good point of talking about vulnerabilities, because everybody is vulnerable at certain times in their lives. And again, as you mentioned, children, they're vulnerable, and you know, they are what they are. And when people get old, they also are what they are, and they should not be looked down upon or shunned or whatever. It's kind of like just engaging with them and enjoying them for what they can offer.
Right.
So it's a very good Good. Those are very positive points that you've been bringing forward, Rachel. Okay. Do you want to comment on the topic of ageism and how that is portrayed by the media and how elder abuse is? I think we just talked about that. According to your research, one way of viewing ageism is that elderly are more vulnerable to interpersonal crimes, such as telephone scams. So we just covered that question. There is a commentary on age segregation and housing, which you touched on. You have also commented on social exclusion and how abuse of guardianship and power of attorney can deny elderly people meaningful roles in families, communities, and organizations. When it comes to the elderly and their caregivers, there is a power imbalance. Do you want to expand on that relationship?
Sure. Yeah, I think what we see happening across families and organizations, for example, is reflective of our broader culture, whereby, again, in pathologizing later life or presenting being elderly as a problem, we lose sight of the tremendous potential of an aging population. We've, through our attitudes and policies and behaviors or practices, we've turned older adults into objects of care through these dehumanizing practices. So we've turned older adults into objects of care who are acted on, and where third parties largely decide to speak and act on a person's behalf. We often override their personhood or identity, which is a unique compilation of a person's entire life. And when we look at the position of older adults or the elderly in society, we often leave them with no role or status. They become objects in legal and economic transactions, which often benefit those who are said to be providing care. So we can look at many examples. We can look at the long-term care industry, the assisted living industry, the home care industry, and many of those involved benefit or profit in some way from taking over a person's assets in the name of their care. But when we look closely, are they really, is care really what's going on? Just to give one example, in 2020, in the first year of the pandemic, the total operating revenue of what's called the nursing and residential care facilities industry grew by over 7% to $34.6 billion. And this is in a context where over 17,000 elderly people died in these facilities during the pandemic. And again, these facilities are said to provide professional 24/7 care. Now, during this time, multiple third parties, such as family members, journalists, those working within the sector, the Canadian Armed Forces, and the United Nations have all drawn attention to how deaths at that time were being classified as solely due to a virus. And yet those dying were suffering greatly from neglect, from dehydration, from solitary confinement akin to imprisonment, were being polydrugged or the use of multiple powerful medications such as antipsychotics and sedatives, and this all at a time in one's life when one needs the most care. So again, going back to the title of that article, we have a tendency to refer to older adults as care recipients, but when we look closely at what is going on, we should be asking, well, who receives? Because all of this money is being transferred in the name of care of the elderly population, and across these facilities, they were dying en masse. from preventable causes. So there is, you know, scholarship and advocacy that is truly critical of the term carer. Care is a term that sounds nice, but when we look closely, we often see the absence of care or even a series of assaults on older adults' quality of life and state of mind. So when we hear or talk about care of the elderly, whether it's companies, organizations, families, individuals, we need to be aware of the power dynamics. And really this practice of putting people away behind closed doors in any setting, community or institutional, puts people at higher risk of neglect and abuse. And again, when it's behind closed doors, it often goes undetected or without consequence.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, yeah, that's very, those are very good points that you're raising. And during the pandemic, I don't believe that anybody was allowed to go into any nursing homes. Is that correct? They could visit their relatives they would have be able to put things through a little hole or something that they was allowed to give them something, or they were not allowed to have any human contact. They would be out, the visitors, the family would be outside, and the people in care were tremendously lonely, and they could not have physical contact with their family.
That's right. And it was above and beyond what the rest of society was subject to, right? And again, all in the name of care and protection. Meanwhile, these practices actually caused or contributed to illness and death.
Yeah, and when there is, as you say, there's no accountability, when people can't be inside the nursing homes or visit their family, there is no accountability there. And I know, mm-hmm. I know a bit about it. I used to work in these places when I was a student. I used to, a long time ago, I used to work in nursing homes. And I know about that. I know about what happens there.
Right.
Yeah. It's there's a lot that I'm sure things have changed a lot, but just as an example, I recall there was a man whose family was he was spastic, like his knees couldn't straighten out. So his family, his son, built him something that you would put on his legs so that he could straighten them out, and this was helpful to him. And this is just, I'm not going to mention any nursing home in particular. This is one in particular. It was a private nursing home. And we were reprimanded. if a man wanted to have a cup of tea, didn't want to go into the cafeteria to have his cup of tea for breakfast, I gave him a cup of tea, and I got into trouble for that. He was supposed to not have it in his room. He had to go into the dining room. And so I got into trouble for that. The man who had his legs, nobody put anything on his legs that he needed to extend them. But there was one woman, she was quite wealthy, and they catered to her. Every women fancy, they catered to her. If she wanted lipstick on and this and that. So she had all the attention. And so there was this kind of ridiculous situation of care that was directed according to the wealth of the patient or something like that. It never, mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, that was a long time ago, but I had those memories of that, so.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that speaks to, like, again, why do the elderly have no say?
Yes.
In all of these situations, in the quality of their lives, you know, on who to see and who not to see, and under what conditions, on where to have a cup of tea.
Yeah, he couldn't have it in his room. You know, he just didn't want to be. He just wanted to have it in his room. That's all he asked for. And it was all about rules and regulations, and that was it. And anyway, another poignant point that you brought forward is that when others decide to provide help or implement public health directives to help or protect older adults, there seems to be no effort made to seek older adults' consent, perspectives, or experiences. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that speaks to what you were just giving some examples of, right? And then, like, and again, this victim blaming, and really, like, this is like the epitome of gaslighting, where situations where older adults are devalued or even neglected and abused, and then we say these practices are in their best interest or for their care and protection. I think we should be valuing a person's, like, sense of self and identity, like, perhaps the most if you reach later life, right? Like, you've contributed all your life to society, and then instead of getting the most, like, attention or resources or respect, we seem to be doing the opposite.
Yeah.
And saying, like, oh, well, they have dementia or they can't remember what day it is, so we need to decide for them. It's unscientific, because, like we already talked about, just because someone has cognitive impairment doesn't mean they're no longer there. We might need to change our ways of communicating with them or understanding them,
mm-hmm.
but they're still there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So
yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. And
And then again, we see that in the media coverage, right? Whereby, like, often there were, like, most articles did not include the voices of older adults at all. And that was the topic of the story, was their quality of life and their well-being and their care. And it's always third parties, you know, speaking on their behalf.
Mm-hmm.
So,
speaking
and then that
for
often
them.
Happens just in interactions too, where, like, mm-hmm. we're talking about the person as if they're not there and they're sitting right there. Right.
Yeah,
and, I think in psychology that's called malignant positioning, whereby these are all, like, dehumanizing practices that over time chip away or erode at a person's, like, dignity and sense of self. And I also know that, like, in palliative care, it's always said that hearing is the last to go. And just anecdotally, you know, I know of many situations with grandparents or whatnot, or friends' grandparents, where it's like the person is hearing impaired, but sometimes they're in the other room and they'll talk about them, and the person's like, I can hear you talking about me.
No.
This idea that hearing is the last to go, and not everything can be explained physically. You know, maybe on paper the person's hearing impaired, but we should always, always try to solicit the perspectives and wishes of the older person. And it's just become such common practice to make decisions on other people's behalf.
Mm-hmm. So the older person in that sense is very vulnerable, because their rights are kind of walked over. People are just making decisions for them, and you know, they're kind of on the sidelines. It sounds like a very awful situation to be in, you know, when you think of it.
Right.
Nobody wants to be in that situation. For sure.
That's right. Nobody yeah. wants to be in that situation.
When you put yourself in that position and you're seeing those that are in power making decisions for you and deciding what you need and what you shouldn't have and so on. And, you know, that's something to consider for sure. Your research covered the influence of the media in their reporting of older adults and also their caregivers. How are they portrayed in the media? Do you want to elaborate on that?
sure. So, I mean, I mentioned earlier burdensome, and then concomitantly this idea that those who try to care or accompany older adults are burdened by their basic human needs. And so, yeah, those trying to provide care are often framed as either heroes or martyrs, or as victims of the older person's needs. So this really, it individualizes the broader problem, which is namely ageism and a lack of value, role, or status of older adults in our society, which, as you were just mentioning, Mary Jane, nobody wants to be in that position. It literally can make it unsafe to be old. And this is some of what I'm exploring in my own PhD research over the next year. But also this label of dementia, which we throw around so freely. Dementia is an umbrella term for symptoms of cognitive impairment. And we assume that dementia is a disease of old age. We neglect to be aware of the many social causes or inducements of cognitive impairment. For example, isolation, which we've been talking about, has been medically proven to cause or contribute to cognitive impairment, right? The severing of relationships and meaning in everyday life. And isolation can cause cognitive impairment. Also, what I mentioned earlier, polypharmacy, which is the practice of using multiple prescription drugs and multiple classes of prescription drugs, is common practice toward the elderly. The last time I checked with federal data, older adults, those 65 and older, are the most drug demographic in Canada. And this can cause a host of medical problems over time, including malnutrition through malabsorption, which I'm sure you would have even more insight on, Mary Jane, as a nutritionist. And again, cognitive impairment. But when we constantly throw around the label of dementia and say dementia is a disease of old age, we neglect to identify how our social practices are actually, in many cases, making the elderly ill.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Yeah, I really feel medication is, well, I'm not one for taking drugs anyways, but I really think that it's overused, and there are ways, natural ways of treating people. And I think medication is often used as a method of control. You know, so it's, the person can't be too much of a problem. I think it's a way of controlling people. Would you agree with that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it can certainly be very, reactive instead of proactive. And I think when it comes to cognitive impairment, there's often a failure to rule out what the cause is. So, again, we want to just give this disease label of dementia, you know, which assumes that a person's, brain is broken or not functioning anymore, and it's a disease, as opposed to maybe looking at, what is this person's everyday life right? Mm-hmm. Which you can't usually determine in a clinical setting. What's their home environment? What's their everyday life? Mm-hmm. What prescriptions are they on? So there's there has been what's called the deprescribing movement, whereby medication should be routinely reviewed. Because there can be drug interactions, right? Where especially if you're taking multiple prescription drugs, they mm-hmm. can interact, yes, and cause these symptoms. But if we just say you have dementia, and again, this is thrown around really loosely also, not just by medical personnel, but the public, right? We're just so quick to assume that a person has dementia because they appear elderly and mm-hmm. and perhaps forgetful. But like I said, things like dehydration can cause cognitive impairment, and dehydration is really common among older adults, especially in facilities, but it can happen in the home environment too. Prolonged isolation, right? The severing of relationships. all of these can lead to those symptoms. And if we just simply prescribe more, we're actually worsening the problem instead of addressing the cause.
Mm-hmm.
And also understanding that all of our, like, our capacity can fluctuate even in a day, right? Like, if I'm really sleep deprived, my mental ability is going to change, right?
Mm-hmm.
If someone's intoxicated, their mental capacity can change. So it's not a stable thing. Like, it fluctuates for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
But we want to just sort of throw around these labels and
mm-hmm.
you know, not looking at the role of circumstance.
That's a good point, for sure. And just lastly, Rachel, your research also summarized the approach taken by Minusinkekiwa, a Good Home Indigenous Seniors Research Committee, and the acronym is ISRC, chaired by Lucille Bruce and Joanne Mason. Do you want to comment on this particular type of research?
Yeah, it would be great. I would be happy to connect you with these women. This was a community-based project in Winnipeg. Maybe in the future you can have them on your show to discuss their work more. But what I can say from working with this tremendous group of women is that they've been working to collect and document the different circumstances of Indigenous older adults in urban centers like Winnipeg. And really, their goal is to envision home and care from a more cultural perspective. And again, moving away from models of warehousing or putting away older adults and calling it care, since this is often unsafe, and looking to solicit the views of older adults in the community, and to look at even like building and urban design, for how we can create homes or places of living that truly are, that do involve care or caring practices, whereby older adults have a valued role and have relationships of their choosing. So their report, Minusinkekiwa, A Good Home, is also available freely online. I believe there was media coverage when that report was released last fall. The fall of 2025. But yes, that's the work of the Indigenous Seniors Research Committee in Winnipeg. And I think they're doing very important work and really sort of the practical aspects of all of what we've been talking about.
Yeah, that's, thanks for mentioning that. That'll be something very, a very good topic to explore for sure. And well, thank you, Rachel, for joining us this morning. It was a pleasure talking to you, and you've made some very good comments that we should all be aware of. We should all take heed about our, you know, to be mindful of how we see, how we think of elderly people and how we treat them and so on. And your research is very, very going to be very helpful to a lot of people, I'm sure. So,
well, thank you. Thank you, Mary Jane, for your time and having me today.
You're very welcome. And I think you have a song that you'd like, that you had suggested. And I think John has just pulled it up. So we were going to listen to it right now.
Yeah. It's a song called Nakai. I don't know what band sings it. It doesn't say here.
We'll see what it says.
This was a song that was put together by mostly local artists in Winnipeg with some women who are visiting from South Africa. So Mpo Mambira from Winnipeg, Katie Ryder, I'm missing some last names here, but George, Bill, and then Nosifo and Tiny were visiting from South Africa, and they put this song together, which I suggested because it speaks to, you know, basically our shared humanity. And I know that all of these individuals, they have just a love for music, and it's a beautiful song. And I just think it speaks to a lot of what we've been talking about.
Here we go.
Thank you.
You're listening to Wooden Spoon.
You're listening to Wooden Spoons on CKUW 95.9 FM. Time right now is 8:52 a.m.
Well, we're nearly the end of our program. I'm going to make a few announcements. I want to mention that at Mary Jane's Cooking School, if you like to check the website, we're having vegan vegetarian cooking being offered on Thursday evenings in March from the 5th, the 12th, 19th, and 26th. And to register, you just call Mary Jane's Cooking School at 204-775-2522 or email mjcookin@mymts.net. We're located at 252 Arlington Street, just south of Portage Avenue. We also have gluten-free cooking on Thursday afternoons in April. And we have some cooking classes. I'm still trying to get started in January and for teens. And that will be, they will be held on Thursday evenings. I would just like to mention some information from the Organic Consumer Association. This was received on January 15th, 2026. There's a herbicide that works like chemotherapy. Now, this is Monsanto sees the opportunity presented by the use of Roundup-resistant superweeds to develop additional genetically engineered traits to crops like corn that could soak up a wide range of herbicides, including 2,4-D, dicamba, glufosinate, and others such as imazamox, isoflatol, mesotrione, oxanil, sulfonylurea, and HPPD-inhibiting herbicides. Monsanto is known for making such wonderful things like glyphosate, which has contaminated all the grains that are grown except for organically grown products. Farmers continue to struggle with herbicide-resistant weeds, however, and so Bayer, which bought Monsanto and retired its infamous name in 2018, is getting ready to roll out icofolin methyl, its first new herbicide in over 30 years, one that the company says has exceptional safety. And yes, they're genetically engineering crops to tolerate it. Now, there's no reason to believe Bayer that icofolin methyl is safe, but as Claire Robinson of GM Watch conceded, there's little or no information available on its possible toxicity to humans or the environment. This is now we're talking about Bayer. Icofolin methyl mode of action could help us predict how it might impact human health, but what exactly is that is unclear. Robinson found an article published by Bayer scientists that makes the remarkable admission that even they don't understand how the herbicide works to kill plants. They say it's probably by binding to bee tubulins, whatever that is. Pharmaceuticals that target bee tubulins are used in chemotherapy to treat cancer, a disease linked to glyphosate exposure. Now, glyphosate is one of the things that has been built into the plants, kills the monarch butterfly, has been responsible for their demise. Of course, nobody is even bringing them to account for this, as the powers of these corporations are immense. So will Bayer be poisoning eaters with one herbicide and treat them with another? Turbulent binders come with severe side effects, including toxicity to the brain and blood. Bayer says icofolin methyl kills weeds, but is harmless to people. They told that lie about glyphosate. Monsanto did. They expect us to believe them now. So this is a commentary. So the Organic Consumers Association is an organization that supports healthy foods and organic farming and has very good does very good research. So that's just some of the information I'd like to share to be aware of what these particular crops are going to be providing for us in terms of health risks, I guess. I don't know if I have time to share a recipe.
I got 3 minutes.
3 minutes, okay. Carrot and red lentil soup with coconut milk. It sounds like a wonderful recipe, and I wanted to share it. It calls for 1 tablespoon of unsalted butter, 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 1 red onion sliced, 1 leek, white part only, finely chopped, 1 teaspoon of ground cumin, 1 teaspoon of finely chopped fresh thyme, stems removed, 2 cloves of garlic minced, 1 large tomato, blanched, peeled, seeded, and diced, which is optional, 1 tablespoon of double concentrated tomato paste, which is, or you can just use twice as much as a regular tomato paste, 2 cups of peeled and sliced carrots, 4 to 5 of them, 1 cup of dried red lentils rinsed and sorted, 4 cups of hot water, 1 bay leaf, sea salt and black pepper to taste, 1/4 cup of unsweetened coconut milk or more to taste, 1 tablespoon of squeezed lemon juice or to taste, and for a garnish you can use lime segments and chopped cilantro or crushed peppercorns. And so what you have to do in a large pot, you melt the butter over medium heat, add the oil, then add the onion, leek, cumin, and thyme, and cook for 3 to 4 minutes, stirring until fragrant and the onion is soft. Add the garlic and cook for 1 minute. Add the tomato and tomato paste and cook for 2 or 3 minutes, until the tomatoes are softened. Add the carrots, lentils, cold water, and bay leaf, and season with salt and pepper. Cover and simmer for about 20 minutes until the vegetables and lentils are soft. Remove from the heat, discard the bay leaf, and transfer the soup to a bowl or food processor or use an electric hand blender and puree until smooth. Return the soup to the pot and stir in the coconut milk. Reheat and check the seasoning for coconut milk and sea salt and pepper. Serve in bowls with a squeeze of lime juice, cilantro, and crushed red peppers. So, as you know, Mary Ann Sorelli will be here next week on Wooden Spoons as we alternate. And thank you for joining us this morning on Wooden Spoons. Mary Ann Sorelli and Kaylin Spain, I should say, will be joining Wooden Spoons next week as we are alternating. And thank you for joining us this morning. And thank you, John, for being our co-host.